Imagine a routine street stop that just, you know, spirals so far out of control that detectives are literally dragging a man through the broken glass of a civilian liquor store.
Right. And the crazy part is nobody's radio or body camera is even turned on.
Exactly. So welcome to today's deep dive. If you are a law student looking to really sharpen your understanding of civil rights and police liability, we are stepping out of the neat, tidy world of appellate case law today, and we're dropping right onto the pavement.
Yeah, we are dissecting the anatomy of a really recent, highly controversial police encounter involving a man named Timothy L. Brown.
And our map for this entire breakdown is a super detailed, completely unsparing legal brief written by Eric Sanders of the Sanders Firm, PC.
I mean, the Sanders brief is a fascinating document, right? Because it just refuses to treat this incident as another isolated viral video. It forces a complete examination of the exact chronological sequence of state action.
Right. We're looking at a progression that moves from a curb into a business and then, well, eventually into the deep systemic failures of modern policing. But before we get into the weeds, I do want to make a quick note for you listening.
Yeah, that's important to clarify.
Right. Because the source material today dives into incredibly charged topics, you know, regarding race, policing, the justice system. And we want to be completely clear here. We are impartially reporting on the legal analysis provided in this brief.
Exactly. We are not endorsing any specific political viewpoint.
No, our mission is just to unpack the complex arguments the author makes so that if you're studying civil rights litigation, you can fully grasp the constitutional stakes at play.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Sanders actually argues that this incident isn't just about excessive force.
Right, it's bigger than that.
Way bigger. It's a fundamental clash between what he terms the overseer mentality and the strict, you know, constitutional requirements of modern policing.
It really serves as a masterclass in analyzing what happens legally when tactical discipline just completely collapses in the field. So we have to start at the very beginning of the encounter. Because legally speaking, the sequence of events dictates the entire constitutional framework.
Yeah, where it starts, changes everything.
Exactly. The incident with Mr. Brown started outside on the street and then violently spilled into a confined liquor store.
I mean, we're talking about a civilian space here. It's populated with workers, witnesses, filled with glass refrigerators and slippery floors.
Yeah, the physical setting itself magnified the disorder exponentially.
It really did. And the legal significance of moving from a public street into a commercial business, it alters the factual and moral character of the whole event.
But the author highlights that the true systemic breakdown wasn't just the location, right?
Yeah.
It was the operational failures of the detectives involved.
Oh, absolutely. According to the reporting, the detectives had no body-worn cameras turned on. None. And they didn't even use department radios. In fact, after the encounter had already spiraled into complete chaos, they resorted to using their personal cell phones to call for an ambulance and for backup.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because operating without radios or body cameras, for a law student listening, that's like a surgeon operating in the dark without a scalpel.
That's a great analogy.
Right, because the procedural guardrails are just gone, leaving only blunt human impulse.
And the author emphasizes that omitting body cameras and radios, it isn't just a minor administrative oversight. It signals a severe breakdown in modern tactical discipline.
Let's look at the mechanism there.
Yeah. So no body cameras means there is no internal visual discipline and there's no immediate accountability record being generated.
The officers know they aren't being watched by the institution.
Exactly. And furthermore, the lack of radios removes the ordinary command communication structure. A radio connects an officer to a supervisor, right? To a broader tactical reality.
Without it, they just isolate themselves.
Which directly escalates the incident because it removes the very elements that are specifically designed to restrain bias and, you know, impose order on uncertainty.
And then we hit the devastating factual twist that completely undercuts the initial legal justification for the stop in the first place.
The drug charge.
Right, the drug charge. The detectives suspected Mr. Brown of a drug purchase. But after this incredibly violent altercation, no drugs were actually found.
Nothing.
He wasn't even charged with drug possession.
Yeah.
And the underlying charges that were filed were quickly headed for dismissal.
And that, I mean, that is the pivot point where the legal liability just explodes for the department.
Because there's no viable criminal predicate anymore.
Exactly. Once there's no predicate, the force used can no longer be legally packaged as just incidental to a lawful arrest. The use of force becomes the primary isolated event.
Wow.
Yeah, with the tactical guardrails completely gone and the underlying charge basically evaporated, Sanders argues that what fills that vacuum is the psychological framework of the officers.
Which moves us from the physical tactical actions into what the author terms the overseer mentality.
Yeah.
Let's break down what that actually means in a strict legal context.
Right. So the brief defines the overseer mentality as a pre-constitutional worldview. It is a mindset that treats certain communities, overwhelmingly Black and Brown communities, not as citizens vested with constitutional rights, but as bodies.
Bodies to be managed, dominated, and subdued.
Right. Exactly. Under this framework, police authority is seen as entirely self-justifying. Any failure by the civilian to instantly submit to that authority is viewed as inherently suspicious.
And deserving of immediate physical consequence.
Yes. It is the absolute antithesis of command presence.
The author makes a really sharp point here, too. When officers substitute professional judgment and patience with speed and contempt, it leads directly to excessive force.
And they destroy their own credibility in the process and, by extension, the institutional legitimacy of the entire department in the eyes of the community.
Because professional policing is fundamentally supposed to impose order on uncertainty.
Right, but when officers act on impulse shaped by this overseer mindset, every ordinary human reaction gets reclassified as disobedience.
So, like, the civilian's natural confusion is read as non-compliance.
Yes. And their fear is documented as furtiveness. Their basic self-protective movements, those are written up as active resistance.
Wait, help me connect the dots here. Because if you're a law student looking at this from a defense perspective, isn't policing inherently chaotic? Adrenaline is pumping, scenes evolve in fractions of a second.
Sure, absolutely.
So how do we legally distinguish between an arrest that is just messy but lawful and what the author is describing is punitive rage?
Well, the author's answer is grounded in the very nature of delegated state power. The law delegates coercive authority to law enforcement specifically because officers are supposed to be heavily trained to maintain discipline in the face of that exact chaos.
Yeah, so difficulty is not a legal license to become punitive.
Exactly. The brief draws a hard, bright line between lawful enforcement and extrajudicial punishment.
So because Mr. Brown committed no underlying crime, the physical force we see, you know, the punches, the shoving into a refrigerator, dragging him across broken glass, all of that morphs from a clumsy arrest tactic into literal street-level punishment.
It becomes the street-level imposition of bodily consequence. It's entirely untethered from lawful adjudication.
It stops functioning as a disciplined tool of law enforcement and starts functioning as a message of domination.
Yeah. The officer effectively acts as the prosecutor, the judge, and the executioner of pain right there on the floor of the liquor store.
Which is wild.
Right. Because in a constitutional democracy, the state is simply not entitled to bypass the courts and inflict bodily harm as a penalty for mere noncompliance.
So if the legal fallout is so disastrous when the underlying drug charge evaporates, the institution finds itself in a massive bind.
Oh, totally. They need a new legal justification for the violence.
And the brief points out that this is almost always where the narrative of resisting arrest enters the picture. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, it basically functions as a legal salvage operation.
A salvage operation. The author explains how the word resisting is deployed by institutions not as an objective explanation of facts, but as a conversion tactic.
Right. It's designed to take the victim's natural human reactions to being attacked, the fear, the confusion, the basic biological instinct for self-protection, and legally convert those reactions into the root cause of the violence.
That is such a crucial shift to understand. And to understand the mechanism of this defense, the brief connects this modern police paperwork directly to the legal history of the Black Codes.
Yeah, going back to the post-Civil War era, historically, Black autonomy, mobility, and really any refusal to remain fixed in a subordinate position were treated as inherent threats.
The law was literally structured to require coercive intervention against Black bodies that did not demonstrate total submission.
It was baked into the system. And the author brings up the harrowing 1855 case of the state of Missouri v. Celia to really drive this doctrinal continuity home.
For anyone studying the evolution of self-defense law, this is where the light bulb goes off regarding systemic bias. Walk us through Celia's case.
So Celia was a 14-year-old enslaved girl who killed her enslaver, to stop him from repeatedly raping her.
Okay.
Her defense attorneys attempted to argue that she was legally resisting sexual assault. And at the time, Missouri law generally recognized the right of a woman to use deadly force to resist forced sexual violation.
The court refused to apply that to her, right?
Exactly. The court refused to instruct the jury that this statutory right applied to an enslaved woman. The legal mechanism the judge used was to just carve her out of the statute entirely.
So the law recognized her as a rational being only for the purpose of holding her criminally responsible and punishing her.
Yes. It completely denied her the legal dignity and protection of self-defense.
Wow. That is incredibly heavy to process. But it's vital to understanding how the law defines self-defense resistance today.
Right. The author is pointing out that Seeley's case serves as a historical template for modern resisting charges.
The legal system historically, the author argues, often currently, denies any legitimacy to black resistance while simultaneously preserving complete, unquestioned legitimacy for the violence of the powerful state actor.
That inversion is exactly what the text wants us to analyze. A black person is subjected to force, often before the legal basis for the encounter is even established. Then the institutional explanation arrives, quote, he resisted.
And that single phrase asks the public, the prosecutors, and the courts to just stop inquiring about whether the initial stop was lawful at all.
Or whether the force was gratuitous. It shifts the entire burden of the violence onto the person who was just beaten.
But what happens when the resisting narrative isn't enough? Because in the age of cell phone video, people can see the blood and the broken glass for themselves.
Yeah, a police report claiming resistance doesn't hold up when the video shows an unprovoked escalation.
So the brief argues that when the physical assault and the paperwork assault both fail, the institution shifts to assaulting the victim's reputation.
This brings us to the misuse of sealed records.
Right. In New York, criminal procedure law, specifically CPL 160.50, dictates that certain records of arrests that do not result in convictions must be sealed.
The substantive practical purpose of this law is to prevent old, unproven allegations from being used as perpetual social weaponry against a citizen.
It's a form of narrative laundering. The state tries to wash an unconstitutional use of force through the muddy waters of a victim's past.
Precisely. The author details how departments sometimes leak these sealed records to the press to dirty up a victim.
It is a calculated secondary assault.
Yeah, the goal is to make the public feel that the victim was never fully innocent anyway, which psychologically lowers the public's moral standards for what the police are allowed to do to them.
So as future lawyers, how should the listener view the institutional legal liability created by this specific tactic of leaking records? It seems like a massive gift to a civil rights lawsuit.
Oh, it creates enormous civil rights exposure. The state cannot insist that records are sealed by law and then turn around and treat those exact same records as a public relations resource the moment its officers are in trouble.
It destroys public trust.
Completely, because it shows the institution operating selectively honoring the law only when it is politically convenient.
And from a litigation standpoint?
From a litigation standpoint, it extends the damage of the original encounter into a demonstrable, malicious, reputational smear. It gives civil rights attorneys hard evidence of bad faith and systemic retaliation.
Which often negates various legal immunities the city might try to claim.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? If the legal fallout is so disastrous and the civil liability is so high, why do officers still default to this overseer force-first mentality?
Well, the text points the finger directly at the systemic messaging from police unions.
The author presents a really sharp critique of union leadership here, specifically focusing on organizations like the PBA and the DEA.
He argues that these unions posture as the ultimate defenders of the rank and file, but their reckless rhetoric actually teaches officers the same destructive lessons over and over.
The brief says unions essentially tell officers to act first, and the machine will protect them later. It's a playbook of, like, force first, let the narrative catch up.
Right, and the author evaluates why these outdated union defense strategies actually hurt officers. They're fundamentally a trap.
By normalizing the overseer mindset, and by dressing up gratuitous violence as necessary toughness.
Exactly. The unions are marching their own members straight into avoidable, career-ending legal consequences.
Let's talk about the mechanism of that trap, because reality eventually arrives, right?
Always. The cell phone video surfaces, the civilian witnesses in the liquor store speak to the press, and the underlying drug charges collapse.
The author uses this incredibly vivid phrase, the public guillotine. The union leaders space safely behind their microphones in their air-conditioned offices, issuing press releases.
While the individual officers are left out on the public guillotine to face the legal wreckage.
And this ties directly into the modern legal landscape of qualified immunity and departmental discipline.
Yeah, because qualified immunity might protect an officer who makes a split-second mistake in a genuinely ambiguous, dangerous situation.
But it does not protect an officer who engages in a clear, documented constitutional violation that was entirely avoidable.
The reality is that failing to prioritize de-escalation and simply following the old force-first union playbook actively strips officers of their legal cover.
Real protection from a union would mean telling officers the hard truth.
Which is that public violence without a solid, lawful foundation is career destruction. It puts them in criminal jeopardy and ruins their lives.
So a union properly serving its members would prioritize tactical discipline and constitutional boundaries.
Because those are the only things that actually keep an officer employed and out of federal court when an encounter goes sideways.
The author presents a really stark choice for the future of the institution. Policing must choose between the dead weight of the overseer mentality and the disciplined reality of civil rights.
There is absolutely no middle ground. You can't just slap new branding, community outreach programs, or, you know, diversity seminars onto a culture that fundamentally still rewards domination.
Right, because the brief stresses that a diverse city requires diverse thinking and absolute emotional control from its armed representatives.
Civil rights isn't some soft theoretical alternative to public order. It is the absolute minimum requirement of lawful public service.
Without strict adherence to those rights, public power doesn't have any moral legitimacy.
It just has coercive force, which makes it indistinguishable from the violence it is supposed to prevent.
So, to summarize the journey we've been on today, we've gone from a tactical collapse lacking basic communication tools like radios and body cameras,
to the historical ghosts of the Black Codes haunting the modern resisting narrative,
and finally, to the severe professional liabilities officers face when relying on outdated union rhetoric and illegal reputational smears.
As a student of the law, your job will be to scrutinize the complete sequence of state action in cases exactly like this one. You have to train yourself to see how bias operates practically.
It doesn't just show up in obvious slurs. It shows up in the tempo of an escalation.
It shows up in the convenient absence of a body camera.
Or the sudden reliance on a resisting arrest charge when the primary crime vanishes into thin air.
You have to be the one to look past the sanitized police reports and hold institutions to the strict, uncompromising boundaries of constitutional policing.
That means examining the entire timeline, from the moment an officer steps onto the curb to the moment the handcuffs click, and demanding a lawful justification for every single escalation. I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you head into your next class or open your next casebook. We talked extensively about how the legal framework of resisting arrest is historically rooted in denying a marginalized person's basic human right to bodily self-preservation.
Right.
If that is true, at what point must our modern justice system entirely redefine what constitutes lawful compliance when a citizen is faced with blatantly unconstitutional state force?
That is a question that challenges the very foundation of how the state interacts with the public.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep reading the footnotes, keep challenging the narratives, and keep questioning the legal structures around you. We'll see you next time.